a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now...
Hello, Dr. Carl.
Oh, how sweet. You really know how to get to my heart, Dr. Maggie.
Happy Thursday morning. It is time to get into your science questions today. 1-300-055-36. And actually, coming up today, we have a very special guest. His name is Stephen Goldfarb. Can you tell us a bit about him, Dr. Carl?
He's the Education and Outreach Officer at CERN, and he was kind enough to help me get organised to go down into the belly of the beast on the border of Switzerland and France to get into the Large Hadron Collider and see my new best friend forever, the CMS, the Compact Muon Solenoid, which has more steel in it than the Eiffel Tower, and blow me down, is used to look at things so small you can't see them, which is odd that you need such a big tool. And basically the whole thing is about the Higgs field. And I was reading in the paper this morning that, you know, those earnest missionary people, I feel so sorry for them. They come from America, they go around to the houses, and they get so much rejection, the poor guys. Anyway, they went to a house in Kiraville, in outside of Sydney, in Wollongong. And they said, look, it's okay. The scientists have just proved that God does exist. And they found God with the Higgs kaleidoscope. Exact quote. I know. They don't know what a kaleidoscope is. I feel sorry for these guys because they're so far away from home and everybody rejects them. And I always try to be nice to them just because if I was in a foreign country, I'd like people to be nice to me.
All right.
So we're going to talk about the Higgs, and I have a 45-second explanation of that. So bring your Higgs questions up, boson questions up, all that sort of stuff, because Stephen is one of the many men who can answer, and women.
We're going to clear up that God-particle confusion there, and I'm sure we're going to be talking big machines as well today. But first up, we're going to be chatting about your general questions. And first of all, we've got Malcolm from Bundamba. Hello, Malcolm.
Oh, hello.
Dr. Malcolm, welcome.
What's your question today?
Now, I want to find out. Now, I've got two identical cars and a 100-kilometre straight stretch of road.
Yep.
Now, I want to find out whether one car is doing 50 kilometres for the entire journey to the end,
yep,
and another car is doing 100 kilometres per hour to the end of the journey. Which car would have the greater amount of kilometres on the clock?
Oh, are they covering the same distance?
Yes, yes, for the 100-kilometre radius, from 0 to 100. And one will be doing 50, one will be doing 100 k's an hour. Because I said to my wife on the weekend, I said, I think that if one car was doing 50, the other car was doing 100, I think the one that was doing 100 would have more kilometres on the clock because it's travelling a quicker speed at a, because it, the tyres are rotating faster, so it would put more kilometres on your vehicle.
But don't they do the, ignoring relativistic effects, don't the tyres do the same number of rotations?
Well, that's what I want to find out,
whether
if the car, one car was doing 50 k's an hour, the other one was doing 100. Because I think that if the cars are travelling through the same distance of 100 k's, if the car that was doing the more greater kilometres speed-wise would actually put more kilometres on the vehicle's odometer.
What do you think, Dr. Carl?
No, a kilometre is a kilometre. With relativistic effects, the faster you go, the more distance shrinks. But in this case, if you've travelled 100 kilometres, it doesn't matter whether you do it at 1 kilometre per hour or 100 kilometres per hour, your wheels have done the same number of rotations, unless I'm misunderstanding the questions.
That's what I say. But, I mean, all I wanted to find out was if one car was doing half the speed of the other car and it was doing from 0 to 100 kilometres, and on a straight, flat stretch of road without any inclines or declines, whether the one car that was doing 50 would actually have less kilometres on the odometer than what the car that was doing 100 k's to the end of the journey. And like, you know, because the tyres are actually rotating faster, whether it would actually...
But they don't do more rotations. They still do the same number of rotations.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that might be your answer, Malcolm.
I think so. This distance stuff can be tricky.
Yeah.
I might have lost my bet.
Maybe.
we'll double check our calculations and we'll let you know, Malcolm. Thank you very much for your question,
That's
Malcolm.
All right.
We're going to head to Michelle now in Darwin. Hello, Michelle.
How are you going?
Good. What's your question today?
I've got a little baby, and a lot of my friends have got babies the same age that are teething, and they're all wearing these little amber necklaces that their mums claim stop the teething pain. And I thought it all sounded a bit crazy, but I was wondering if you guys had heard of it or if you knew anything about it.
This has come up on my Twitter homepage, and people have done a search for it in the academic literature to see if there is anything in the academic literature to show whether amber necklaces do reduce teething problems, and the answer is no.
No?
No. They might, but I find it really, really unlikely. It's, to me, it's about as likely if you've got a problem with your car and every now and then you've got a coughing when you, in the engine when you change from second or third gear, somebody says, put this bit of amber in the glove box, but you have to hold it down with blue tack that you've put there on the full moon. But for me, it just sounds like complete rubbish. And there's nothing.
That's
in the
what I was thinking. Yeah. So I'm glad you've confirmed that.
Well,
for me.
Only in the sense that there might be something that hasn't come up in the academic literature, but we haven't found it yet.
Go ahead and spread the info, Michelle.
Will do. Thanks for your help.
No worries. Hey, we're going to head to Surrey Hills now. Hello, Jenny.
Oh, hi.
Dr.
What,
Jenny.
What's your question today, Jenny?
We're all doctors this morning.
Yes.
We do that not because, well, firstly, I'm not a real doctor, unlike Stephen Goldfarb, who'll be answering questions on the Large Hadron Collider and all that sort of stuff. I'm only a medical doctor, but the reason we say call people doctor is so that they don't feel anxious about asking a question in the sense of, that's a stupid question. There are no stupid questions. They all lead to enlightenment. So you're only a temporary doctor. We're not taking anything away from the PhDs who struggle for years to get their PhD.
Okay, so just for this morning then.
Yeah.
Well, next 5 minutes, actually.
My question is, we used to have a pet blue tongue lizard.
Yep.
And we never saw him sneeze. Do lizards sneeze?
Sneezing is a specific reflex that aids the action of the mucociliary ladder. So what is this thing? You've got the nose and the mouth, which then lead to your main airway, the trachea. The trachea is lined with hairs that we call cilia. And these cilia wave in an asymmetric fashion, so they tend to bring stuff up towards your mouth. So dust comes in and they bring it up, and to help the dust stick, they have mucus. So we call this mechanism of these two anatomical things, the cilia and the mucus, we call this the mucociliary ladder. Occasionally, the mucociliary ladder is not enough. So then what you have to do is increase the pressure in the abdomen and close off your larynx or glottis or voice box, and then suddenly release, open it up. And then this burst of air comes out carrying debris. It is a useful reflex in humans, and I know cats have it, and I think that reptiles would have it. What we need is a person called a herpetologist. And I was talking to some herpetologists, and he said, you know how you pick a herpetologist? And I said, no, that's a snake specialist or reptile specialist. He said, look at their fingers. They are more likely to be missing a joint. And so what happens is that if you and me, we see a snake, we go, ah, and run away. Whereas the herpetologists say, look at you. Hello, big fella. Oh, God, there's my joint gone. So a lot of herpetologists are missing it. So if a herpetologist could ring in and just confirm that reptiles do have the or do not have the sneeze reflex, please let us know. I think they would because it's a useful thing. I don't know.
That's a great question, Jenny. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, cheers.
And we are also joined this morning by a very special guest, Dr. Stephen Goldfarb from CERN. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning to talk
it's
science.
It's my pleasure. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Now, can you explain to us a bit about what CERN is and how it relates to this God particle that was discovered last week?
Which is the Higgs, not the man wearing bell-bottom trousers who pipes a little tune as you come onto a ship, the bosun, but rather the boson, named after a guy who was so clever in mathematics that he got 110 out of 100 in the maths exam when he was at high school by solving some of the problems in two different ways, some of which the examiners had not even thought of. So they gave him an extra 10 marks.
He's bright.
Yeah.
Well, okay, let me tell you a little bit. CERN is a laboratory. We're called, try to figure out this acronym here, CERN. It's the European Laboratory for Particle Physics. Okay.
Where's the C come from?
Where's the C? Where's the
N? It's European.
It's European. When it was first started, it was nuclear research. But as we got smaller and smaller in size or higher and higher in energy, went well beyond that. We're in particle physics now. It was founded back in 1954. When we were trying to get all of the nuclear physicists around Europe to get together and work together because they'd just gone through, well, a pretty bad time. So at CERN, we've got a very large accelerator that's
very
famous
large.
Now. Very large. It's called the Large Hadron Collider. You know, it's never a good idea to call something a name like that, right? It's always going to get larger. We're always going to get newer. Never call something the new something or other, because in a few years you'll be old. But it's the Large Hadron Collider. It collides protons together at four different places, and around those places we put detectors to see what happens when you smash the things
and
together.
And why are they underground?
They're underground because it's a beautiful place. So you would not want to have that above ground to start with.
Why? Because there's radiation coming out of it? Or?
There is radiation. When we're running, there's radiation. Although it's completely surrounded and protected, we can't get into it. If we try to go into it while there's beam, it turns off. And then everybody's angry, so we don't do that.
And if you were to go there, would you get a radiation dose that could be dangerous?
If you were inside there, you could get a significant radiation dose.
But it's protected by the 100 meters. So it's large because it's 27 kilometers in circumference. It's hadron because the things that you colliding, which are protons, are a type of hadron, and it's a collider because you collide them together.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. You got it all. The LHC, we refer to it affectionately. And at these four different places, we put these detectors. We try to see what was inside, right? You smash things together. We haven't gotten that far from Og, right? The caveman who smashed rocks together and said, and found out that rocks were made of smaller rocks. We've just gotten a little bit more sophisticated in what we do. And we've gotten to smaller and smaller levels because higher energy, as you know, E equals H nu gets you to a higher frequency, a smaller wavelength, and thus you can probe deeper inside of matter. So we have to go to high energies.
Yeah, well, we're going to find out a lot more about this today. Thanks to the questions from you, and we're going to head to Cairns where Richard is there at the moment. Hello, Richard.
G'day, how are you, doctors?
Yeah,
hi, Dr.
Good.
Richard, welcome.
Hello.
What's your question for Dr. Stephen Goldfarb?
My main question is, by what means do you accelerate the particles, and how do you extract those particles and insert them into the collider itself?
Okay, I think you'd be amazed at how simple the beginning of the Large Hadron Collider is. Picture yourself a small gas canister of hydrogen. That's it. We take that, we turn it on, and the gas comes out. And what we do is we hit that through a target to remove the electrons, and all we're left with is
The Carl? Protons are positive. Hang on, are you saying that instead of going out for this multi-billion dollar project, which, by the way, costs less than three American B-2 bombers, instead of going out and finding beautiful hydrogen atoms and one at a time polishing them, you just went down to your local gas supply and got a $10 bottle?
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
What it starts with. So we start with that.
Yeah.
Right? But then you got a lot of work to do to get them to be in a small, dense area and go to very high energies.
And how do you get rid of the electrons again?
So you take the electrons off. Basically, if you have a target. I'm not exactly sure which target you use.
So the hydrogen atom has a central positive core, which is basically a proton with an electron going around it. And
exactly.
Then you strip the electrons off.
And you do that with a magnetic field. So a magnetic field can then steer the things which are positive.
So you're left with these positive protons.
Okay, so once you've done that, then you've got this sort of this spray of protons. Then everything else is done essentially with electric fields and magnetic fields. So you use magnetic fields to focus them and to curve them around the different accelerators. And we actually use the history of CERN to accelerate it. We sent it into the older accelerators that we built some time ago. And you accelerate them up to energy. And then you go up to higher energies, and then higher energies when we get into the Large Hadron Collider. When we get inside there, you're squeezing it, you're bending it with a variety of different magnets. Some are called dipoles. Others are quadrupoles, sextupoles. Use these to focus it and to turn it. And to boost it, think of your child on the swing, right? You have to hit it just the right time. You hit with an electric field. You hit the protons, and you boost them up to the energy that you want.
Now, Richard, you had a question there again?
So it starts off like a small collider, and as you get accelerated faster and faster, it gets on a bigger loop, or?
Right, exactly, because, you know, you try to take a race car and put it on a really small loop. You can't go too fast without skidding off of the track.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks. Go ahead.
Sorry, from what I can take, the very big one goes across a few countries or something. Is that correct?
It does. Well, Switzerland's not very big to start with, but it's 27 kilometers around, and it goes underneath the French-Swiss border.
All right. Okay. There you go, Richard. I hope that helps.
Yeah.
We are learning so much about the Large Hadron Collider from Dr. Stephen Goldberg from CERN this morning. And we've got another question from Cassie in Brisbane. Hello, Cassie.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
What's your question?
I'm here. Hi. Mine's kind of a silly question. I've been intrigued ever since I heard about it. What's this going to do for nanotechnology, and are we going to be getting closer to George Jetson pressing our button on our briefcase and turning it into a car or vice versa?
Well, look, first thing, Cassie, there are no stupid questions because they all lead to enlightenment.
Exactly.
Okay.
So this is actually predicting what this is going to do for us is an incredible challenge, and that's of course what we're asked the most. It's just like going to Isaac Newton and saying, "What's that going to give for us?" and having him be able to say, "Oh, well, of course you're going to have geosynchronous satellites, and you're going to land on Mars, put things on there." It's almost impossible. If I could, I would have been over at the stock market right afterwards when I knew about the five sigma signal. I don't know specifically. It gives us a big missing piece of the puzzle in understanding our universe and how things work. So it fits into our model and allows us to make predictions and allows us now to know where to go to try to find new things.
Well, I'll give you an example. A couple of hundred years ago, you get some peasant from inside England and he goes down to the seaside and he sees a ship. And on a ship, what they've done is they've got this rock, this magnetic rock, and they've made it into a long, skinny sliver of rock like a pen, and they've glued the rock onto a cork and they've put the cork in a little bowl of water, and it's a compass. And
So
what they're doing, and the peasant has never seen this, and we're like that peasant, and he's never seen this sort of stuff, and he thinks, oh, gee, I wonder what's going on. He's got no idea of a magnetic field. So what we've done now is we've proved that, is this a fair thing to say, Stephen? We've proved that there is a Higgs field that gives mass to matter. Is that a reasonable summary?
Exactly. That was the field is pervasive. The idea that was put forward was that there's this field that's all around everywhere. It was formed just.
A tenth of a billionth of a second after the Big Bang.
Exactly. And at that time, it sort of condensed and it gave some particles mass. Now, your typical particle, like a proton, most of its mass is due to the energy of the quarks and things inside of it. But the elementary particles, at least we have an idea now that they get their mass from this field.
Right. So now think back to our peasant, right? We're at that stage, and a little bit, 2 centuries ago, what happened was that a guy called Faraday, he thought, okay, there's this invisible field called the magnetic field. And secondly, there's this invisible thing called electricity. So he got these two invisible things together and he made an electric motor. And people see that electric motor in the basement at the Royal Institution in London and they burst into tears. I felt really very emotional. I felt like bursting into tears too. Now, who would have thought, if you're looking at a magnetic rock, that you're going to get electric motor? That's where we are now. We've got no idea what's going to come. It'll be big, it'll be wonderful.
No idea.
No, but what is there? There's something will come.
What did Mr. Faraday say when he was asked by the finance minister? What is this going to do for us?
And he said, what is the use of a newborn baby? Yes. So this is our newborn baby, and we don't know what it'll give us.
It's all very exciting. Thank you very much. I just keep thinking back to I think, therefore I am, and I think that this God particle is going to, I don't know, maybe that you're just the particle whatever. Anyway, thank you very much.
So it was Rene Descartes who said, I think, therefore I am. The motto of the astronomer or the scientist is, I think, therefore I get paid.
No worries. Thank you, guys. Right.
Thank you very much, Cassie. In Brisbane, I guess the Higgs boson is our oyster today.
And I have two answers. The studio says, and I quote, my snakes, plural, sneeze.
Mm.
Well, okay. Apparently the reptiles may well indeed have a sneeze reflex. And Christopher says, the most important thing to think of in considering amber necklaces is that they are a potential choking hazard for babies. Okay, onwards to Higgsy stuff.
Though if you do have any answers for us, you can tweet Dr. Carl at DOCTORKARL or text us 0439 757 555. We're very lucky today to have very special guest Dr. Stephen Goldfarb in the studio with us. He is from CERN. He's in the country for a bit of a conference on physics that's been going on past week.
And I had Yellow T-Shirt Man.
Yeah.
Who's Yellow T-Shirt Man?
I know you have the secret of being able to walk through walls. Tell me the secret. You must tell me. He turns up at all the conferences.
Okay, there you go. There's always one, isn't there? We are answering your questions about the Higgs boson, which
boson.
That's
so why you just pronounce it with like a Z. Yeah.
Or a Z. Oh, boson. It's very good. Seeing how you're American
after,
to say
you know
Z.
Who it's named after? Bose.
That's right. Satyendra Bose, who is different from Chandrasekhar Bose, who is a black hole man, who's different from Bose speakers.
Exactly.
There's three smart Bose Indians.
All righty. Well, we're going to go to another question, this time from Michael in Brisbane. Hello, Michael.
How you going, doctors?
Dr. Michael.
Good. What's your question?
Just with the discovery of the Higgs boson and the invention of the Hadron Collider, are we any closer to making nuclear fission more viable?
Okay, you're probably referring to nuclear fusion, right?
Fusion?
Right. Fission we've already been doing since the 40s. Nuclear fusion is a great goal, something we've been looking at, the holy grail of infinite energy that we've been looking for a long time. We're at a different scale here. We're at a much, much smaller scale. It's hard to tell if what we do could have any impact on something like that, but that's the beauty of doing pure research. Perhaps it will.
All right.
So the answer is a definite don't know.
Yeah. Definite don't know.
And it's okay. Thanks, Michael from Brisbane.
Thank you.
We're going to head to Cairns now, where Birdman is on the line. Hello, Birdman.
Hi, Birdman. Birdman.
He flew away.
He had a good question. All right. Well, we might head along to a question from Tim in the Gold Coast. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Dr. Tim. Welcome to the show.
Mate, I'm just wondering if the Higgs field itself is affected by gravity, like by stars and the like.
If the Higgs field itself is affected by gravity, I would say no. The Higgs field, that's not really fair to say. The Higgs boson would be. Mm-hmm. The Higgs boson, which is an excitation of the Higgs field, has a mass. If it has a mass, then it's going to be affected by gravity. The field itself would not.
So it'd be a separate, entirely separate thing from gravity.
Yeah.
My understanding is that the Higgs field popped into existence at a tenth of a billionth of a second after the Big Bang. Gravity is a distortion of the space-time four-dimensional fabric of space. Are the two of them related?
Well, they're related as any forces are. This is another force. Think of it as a separate, independent force when you think of the Higgs
field. But the thing is, you just think back to our peasant who's all he has ever known is pigs, and he sees a compass on the ship, and then he's got no idea that one day there'll be an electric motor. We're at that stage.
Yeah, but say if the force, like electromagnetic force, that's affected by gravity, would that be a completely different sort of situation from the Higgs field?
Yeah, they're all. I mean, that's another force, right? You have photons carrying electromagnetic force, right?
Yeah.
Those are the particles. There's electromagnetic field. Its manifestation is in a photon. For gravity, we expect there's something called a graviton. Although we've never seen it, it's not clear we could ever build something of the energy it would take to be able to detect a graviton. Although there are some models which indicate it could be possible. And then there's the Higgs field, which manifests in its form of a Higgs boson. So
we'd need a theoretician, a tame theoretician.
Sure, sure.
We haven't got one of those. He's an experimentalist. I'm not a physicist.
I just measure.
Yeah. I just ask the people who measure and who do the writing on envelopes.
All right. Thanks, Tim, from the Gold Coast.
Thank you, Dr. Tim.
Thank you. We are talking the Higgs boson today because we are joined by Dr. Stephen Goldfarb from CERN, where they discovered it the other week. And we've got another question from Grant in Altona in Melbourne. Grant, hello.
Good morning, doctors.
Dr. Grant,
good
welcome.
Morning.
As I understand it, the Higgs sort of discovery of the or narrowing down of the mass range that's possible for the Higgs boson confirms some models, I suppose, of the standard theories. Mm-hmm. I was under the impression that string theories were sort of being developed to cover or trying to account for some gaps and holes in the standard model. What are the, and that may be not quite exactly right, but what are the implications for the string theories and membrane type theories of Hawking's and his ilk from this narrowing down, as I say, or pinning down of the mass of the Higgs boson?
Okay, it could give us a little bit more ideas, but let me explain very quickly. So the standard model brings together several different symmetries. So way back at the end of the 19th century, you had Maxwell uniting electricity and magnetism. Now we all do that in school. You take a wire, you curl it around, and you can make a magnet, right? Putting a current through it. We saw those things came together. Then Marie Curie went out and she found the nuclear forces, right? The weak nuclear forces. We brought those together. Glashow, Salam, Weinberg did that in the early 60s. Said, hey, these could be united using with something called a gauge theory. You can make the electroweak force. These are also two sides of the same coin. And there was a problem with that. The problem with that is that for that symmetry, your forces, the carriers of the forces, would all have no mass. And so that didn't work because we saw that the weak nuclear force happened was weak and that it happened at a very short scale. The only way for that to work was if you applied a mass to it. If you applied a mass to it, then the question came up, where does that come from? We have this beautiful symmetry. We need to break it. How do we do it? Thus was born spontaneous symmetry breaking in the theory, something quite complicated. Only someone as bright as Englert and Brute and Higgs, Peter Higgs, could propose. So they proposed something, and that brought that in. So these are some symmetries that have come together. Now, there's still some questions that remain, okay, that bring us all the way to string. So is these forces come together, what about the strong force, the strong nuclear force, the thing that holds together protons? Where does that fit into this? And then, and so we often look for something that's called a grand unifying theory, or a GUT. And string theory takes us even to the point where we try to figure out how do we fit gravity into all of this. Gravity is very strange. Gravity is a 10 to the 33 difference in the strength between your typical forces like electromagnetism and gravity, right? You take your magnet, you go next to your fridge, you let go, the fridge wins significantly over an entire planet underneath your feet.
Gravity is so weak that I can defeat it with the electromagnetic involved in sugar and metabolism and standing up. Every time I stand up, I overcome the gravity of the entire planet.
Exactly.
That's how weak it is.
Exactly. So there's a huge difference there. So string theories really go, you know, way beyond. We're unifying. Right now we're quite happy because we've just sort of completed a model that unifies electricity, magnetism, the weak force, and we have a complete picture there that just works. It works all together now.
So just as a bit of background, the electromagnetic, there's four forces that the physicists think run the universe. They ignore vampires and magic. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the electromagnetic force, radio, television, and the reason you don't fall through the floor because of the repulsion of the electrons of the outer shells. That's the electromagnetic force, number one. Number two, the weak force involved in some forms of radioactive decay. Number three, the gravity force. Gravity sucks. Number four, the strong force. And so we're talking, these are the four forces that Stephen mentioned during his little discussion there.
So I should mention, at least, we did have some smart theorists talking to us at this our conference was called ICHEP, and it was held in Melbourne. You know that place.
Yeah.
And they did mention at the end, what are implications? So like what you're asking. And we looked at a variety of different measurements, not just the Higgs, but other measurements that are coming in. And they look like we could maybe unify things. What you're looking for is string theory, is to unify things at a level of maybe 3 TeV, which is
so the high answer to the question is a definite maybe?
It has an effect. It definitely leads us in a direction, so we can look for that.
Yeah. There's a definite effect, which we can look for.
We know so much, but we've got so far to go.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thanks, Grant. We've got another question for Stephen Goldfarb this morning from Sam in Coffs Harbour. Hello, Sam.
Hi there,
Dr. Sam. Welcome.
What's your question?
I was just wondering, with the Higgs mechanism, why does it only relate to certain particles? So with photons, why don't they interact with Higgs boson?
Oh, well, I'll say one thing here just as an introduction, which is one of the clever physicists at the University of Sydney told me this. He said, light is a wave when it travels, but a particle when it is born or dies. And so you've got a light bulb, it gets hot, a photon is emitted, it immediately turns into a wave, it travels, it then lands on your eyeball where it turns back into a photon. So that's I'm sort of talking about photon and particle and wave. So what's your question again exactly?
Oh, sorry. Why is it that Higgs boson particles slow down protons and electrons to give them mass, but don't give mass to white particles like photons and gluons?
Okay, it's a very good question. Okay, so this is not yet answered.
Why is a photon without mass?
Let me extend that and just say that, you know, we don't yet know why different particles behave differently in the Higgs field. What we know now is that there is a mechanism, what we think we know. Mind you, we see something which looks like a duck and smells like a duck, but it could still be a platypus. We don't yet know. Yeah. We think that we found the Higgs. We suspect that, and we'll know a lot better by the end of the year. So it gives mass to different particles in different ways. And the photon, as it turns out, travels at the speed of light.
And has no mass.
Definition, and it has no mass, whereas others have more. And it depends on how much they couple with it. And I don't want to make a circular argument here. That's just what we've measured. Depending on how much they couple with the Higgs field tells you how much mass they have. So now we know that the photon couples.
So would it be fair to say that the answer to the question, why do different subatomic particles have different masses when they interact with the Higgs field? The answer is find out and you got a Nobel Prize?
Could be, yeah. That's our next big question. It's called the hierarchy question. So why are these different families of particles have these different masses? So why do they interact differently with the Higgs field?
We don't know that yet. All we've done with this is open the door. And that's one of the things hiding behind it.
All right. Thanks, Sam from Coffs Harbour. Thanks for calling in.
No problem.
Thank you, Dr. Sam. Why did they build it underground instead of on the surface of a desert where there wouldn't be people around? It makes it more stable.
How are you going to get physicists to go live on the surface of a desert to work on it?
Offer them money. They get paid almost half as much as plumbers. They're happy with that.
We're not in it for the money, that's for sure.
No. So is there an advantage to having it underground?
Well, there's definite advantage to having underground. First of all, it's a beautiful part of the world. We're between the Alps and the Jura Mountains.
Yeah.
And there are cows on top of the accelerator. So you wouldn't want to have to move them off.
Why underground? Why not just on top of the ground and pile dirt over it? Because it's much
more
dimensionally stable.
That would be ugly. That would be really ugly. No, you don't want to do that there. We dug underground. And also, you could take advantage of the Swiss who like to make holes in pretty much all the mountains around there.
Okay.
So they did an excellent
job. But why underground?
You still want to know why it's underground? You want to be underground, safer down there too. There is radiation when you take a charged particle, you take it and you curve it around. It's going to radiate.
Okay, and the other thing is that it actually cuts down on upkeep and maintenance. You don't have to paint it or anything. It's just underground.
No, we don't paint it.
Yeah,
you don't paint it. Okay, what
we actually had a text from someone saying if it's crossing borders, does the Higgs boson need a passport?
Indeed it does.
Yes,
indeed.
Of course. We are answering your questions today on the Higgs boson because we are joined by Stephen Goldfarb from CERN. And we've got another question today from Birdman in Cairns. Birdman, you're back with us?
I am. I never went anywhere. I think there was a bit of interference with a recent coronal mass ejection from the sun.
Oh, CMEs. Okay.
All right. He knows his stuff. What's your question, Birdman?
Basically, just the fact that you're trying to observe these little particles flying around doing their thing, are you affecting the result and sort of getting a result that you're looking for that way?
So he's talking about the concept of, at the quantum level, the observer effects. Like if I'm looking at a car accelerating from one speed to another, it's so far away from quantum land, I'm not affecting it. But at subatomic levels, you can. So what do you reckon?
Sure. Of course, we affect by measuring. So what we do, so we have, I work on the ATLAS detector, which is one of the four detectors at collision points on the LHC. And what we do is we surround the collision point with this enormous detector. It's 46 meters in length and about 26, 27 meters in diameter. So imagine a big cylinder there. And as the particles come out from the collision, they go through different parts of the detector and you can identify what they are. Now, at the inside, so when there's a collision, at the point of collision, we get 40 million packets colliding every second. And in a packet of protons, you have the same number of protons as you have stars in the galaxy. So you have 10 to the 11, okay? Wow. So 100 billion, you end up with up to, say, 600 million to a billion proton collisions per second. They collide. And we don't know exactly what happened in there. And in fact, thanks to quantum mechanics, what we do know is that absolutely everything could and will happen inside there. Everything is allowed, but what we do measure is what comes out. So the quantum mechanical part, we don't measure it. We can't measure it. It happens at too small of a scale for us to measure. They make the collision. We measure this. We know what went in, and we measure the stuff that comes out, and then statistically we can figure out what happened in the center. So everything we do is based on statistics. So that's where the quantum mechanics comes in. And if you look at, if you happen to see any of the pictures that were in the papers, you'll see some images of a collision. But what was important to us, what we all stood up and cheered about when we were in Melbourne or over in Geneva, when they announced it, was we looked at a statistical mass plot. They had a little bump in it in a certain region that was considered statistically significant compared to our error. And that told us that there was a particle there.
Okay, I got you.
Thanks for the question, Birdman.
Thank you, Dr. Birdman.
Yeah. We're going to head to Brisbane now, and Matt has a question for us. Hello, Matt.
Hello, guys. How are you?
Good.
Hello, Matt.
Question.
First of all, congratulations on everything and a big thank you for all the hard work that you're doing and helping us understand our universe.
Thank you. I will thank everybody when I get back.
Yeah, thank you very much. I've got a two-part question. Number one, is this Higgs field, I know that it's sort of separate from the Higgs boson, but the Higgs field itself, is there anywhere in the universe that it might not exist or is weaker?
Like a black hole where
it is predicted to be absolutely everywhere. That's the prediction.
So it could extend to all the edges of the universe, as far as we know.
I think one of your theorists when we had that meeting on Saturday morning in the Google Hangout said, and I think the quote was, it is now an inherent property of space.
Yes. Now we know about it. It's a scalar field, meaning has no direction.
This astonished me.
This is the first time we found one of these.
Yeah, because you've got a magnetic field, north-south. You've got an electric field, plus minus. You've got a gravity field, sucks to the center of the Earth. Now you've got a field with no direction. Freaky, man.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. The second part to mine, is there any way at all that we could get particles to not pass through this or anything like that so we could take away mass completely?
Well, that's a very interesting thing. That we're going to have to let theorists think about that. I don't know of any way myself. Basically, it's coupled in the formula that we have, which fits on a tie, by the way, now, which we know is correct. it couples with everything. So I don't think so.
Okay.
That's one of the things we'll have to find out in the future, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah, thanks for your question, Matt.
Thank you so much, guys.
Okay, we're sticking in Brisbane, actually. Tim's there. Hello, Tim.
Hello. My question to you guys is, if you get the Higgs boson particle or wave from a proton, if you were to fire an electron through there, would you get a negative matter, an antimatter?
Well, no. The electron would go right through if there's a Higgs field there, the electron gets, we believe it gets its mass from the Higgs field. But you don't, there's nothing antimatter in there.
So antimatter is just like regular matter, except the charges are reversed. Electrons are now positive and protons are now negative.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Thank you very much for your question, Matt. Tim. Thanks very much for that. Man, there is so much to learn and understand about this Higgs boson, but thank you so much, Stephen Goldfarb, for coming in today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And sharing your knowledge from the CERN, place where they found the Higgs boson. Thank you very much for coming in and answering your science questions. Thanks, Dr. Carl.
Thank you. I've learned a lot.